One of the hot debates in academia is now reaching the courts. The question, do universities discriminate against religious conservatives? Some professors and students say yes, but as NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports, it's not an easy charge to pin down.
When Elaine Howard Eklund began asking top scientists whether they believe in God, she got a surprise. Eklund, an assistant professor at Rice University and author of the book Science versus Religion, polled 1,700 scientists at elite universities. Contrary to the stereotype that most scientists are atheists, she says, nearly half of them say they are religious. But when she did follow-up interviews, she found they practice a closeted faith.
They just do not want to bring up that they're religious in an academic discussion. There's somewhat of almost a culture of suppression surrounding discussions of religion at these kinds of academic institutions.
Eklund says the scientists worried that their colleagues would believe they were politically conservative or subscribe to intelligent design. She says they all insisted on anonymity. And it appears that climate may extend beyond science departments. A poll of 1,200 academics by the Institute of Jewish and Community Research found that more than half said they have unfavorable feelings toward evangelical Christians. Ariel Weinberg, who co-authored the study, says one reason for this is that there are relatively few evangelicals in academia.
The question is why? Do they self-select out? And if they do, why are they self-selecting out? Are they actually not hired? Are they trying to get hired but not getting hired? Are they getting hired and then being forced out, not getting tenure?
I haven't encountered that hostility at all.
Randall Balmer is a professor of religion at Columbia University and an Episcopal priest.
I've been a visiting professor at places like Emory and Northwestern and Yale and Princeton and other places, and I simply have not encountered that sort of hostility to my claims of faith or my professions of faith.
Mike Adams begs to differ. Adams teaches criminology at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. A few years ago, he began writing strongly worded op-ed pieces expressing conservative views on religious and political issues. When he applied for promotion to full professor, his colleagues voted him down. Adams sued, claiming, among other things, that he was rejected because of his religious speech.
I think that the evidence in my case very strongly suggests that I was being held to a higher standard and that there was retaliation for expression of my First Amendment rights.
The university declined to comment, but in its brief, it argued that Adams' teaching record did not satisfy the standard of distinguished accomplishment. In March, a federal judge sided with the university. Adams is appealing. David French, an attorney for the conservative legal group, the Alliance Defense Fund, says there is an upsurge of these cases.
The secular public schools are almost becoming, for lack of a better term, quasi-religious in their outlook and devotion to one particular worldview and excluding all those who disagree.
French cites the case of an adjunct professor in California who was dismissed for suggesting that homosexuality might be a choice. A graduate student was thrown out of a counseling program after she declined to conduct relationship therapy for gay couples. And recently, the University of Illinois dismissed an adjunct professor for offending students when discussing the Catholic Church's view of homosexuality. After an outcry, the university reinstated him last week. Carrie Nelson, president of the American Association of University Professors, agrees there may be a culture clash at universities, but he does not believe that translates into systematic discrimination against religious academics.
I think most tenure decisions at responsible and respectable institutions are focused on the written record.
By that, he means, how many peer-reviewed articles have you published? What are your teaching evaluations like? Have you worked on committees? He does not believe people are penalized for their religious views.
That it happens in some places, I'm sure. It has not been coming to the AAUP in the form of cases or complaints.
And because a university does not have to give a reason for rejecting a candidate, it's difficult to tell why precisely a scholar is considered unfit for academia. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Thank you. This is NPR.
An Islamic center is closer to being built near the site of the World Trade Center. New York's Landmarks Preservation Commission voted not to give protected status to a building in Lower Manhattan so it can be torn down to make room for the center. Its supporters say the center is designed to encourage healing. Those who wish it would open in a different location include the Anti-Defamation League, a leading Jewish group whose director is Abraham Foxman. How has the ADL's position evolved on this issue?
I'm not aware that it's evolved. The ADL opposes bigotry, prejudice, Islamophobia, and we continue to do so.
I guess what I mean is that initially the ADL was expressing concern about the critics of this Islamic center, and now the ADL has said that you wish that the Islamic center should be moved somewhere else.
Well, no, we will still continue to be critical about critics of the center who are critics from a perspective of bigotry and racism and Islamophobia. The position that we've articulated last week was one that deals with location and sensitivity. We didn't even say it must, you should, you have to. We basically said that we believe that in this place of tragedy and pain and anguish, maybe the best thing would be is if people would step back and consider that if you want to heal, the best way to heal is not to do it in your face. And if the people who you reach out to, those who had suffered the most, say, please don't do it in our cemetery, not to do it.
What about this specific building or its specific location or its specific design makes it seem a little too in your face?
Well, I don't know about the design. I don't know about that. But for me, it's similar to a position that the Jewish community took about 15, 20 years ago when there was an effort by the Carmelite nuns to build a convent in or around Auschwitz. And we then said, we welcome your love, we welcome your prayers, but please don't do it on this site. This was a controversy for 8 years. We in the Jewish community, we in the ADL, were then accused of being bigots, that we're opposed to Christianity or the Catholic Church. And eventually the Pope understood and said, okay, build it a mile away. I know this imam, and I agree with all those who have said he's moderate. Well, part of the moderation, if you want to show the moderation, is be sensitive to the people you want to reach out to heal.
You said you met the imam, Faisal Abdul Rauf.
Correct.
Have you had a chance to tell him your concerns?
No. I met the imam several years ago. We worked with him. More recently, he reached out to me. He didn't ask for support of the mosque. He basically said to me, Abe, I'm being attacked. My character is being attacked. I'm being called an extremist. And you know me. Will you stand up? And I said, absolutely. And we've stood up as an agency to counter the attacks on his persona, on his character, on him being characterized as an extremist. You know, that's the extent of the conversations we've had.
I wonder if a Muslim who professes to be a moderate Muslim might turn to you and say, why should this cause anybody pain? I may be a Muslim, but I am not the person who flew a plane into the Trade Center. I had nothing to do with it.
So I would say to them, neither were the Carmelite nuns. They had nothing to do 50 years earlier with Auschwitz. Again, everything that I know is he's a moderate. Part of moderation is to be sensitive to those around you who are responding to you out of pain and anguish. And so, you know, I thought it would have been wonderful. Who am I to tell him? But, you know, I guess I'd tell him through this. You know, if he would say, you know what, I do want to heal. I do want to reconcile. I do want to show the American public that there is an American Muslim tradition. That would be a wonderful, dramatic beginning, rather than insisting, this is where we want to heal. This is where we want to reconcile in your cemetery.
Abraham Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League, thanks very much.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The personal Bible of Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon faith, has turned up for sale, asking price a cool $1.5 million. Before the Bible finds a new home, a Salt Lake City bookstore threw open its doors so the public could sneak a peek. From member station KUER in Salt Lake City, Jenny Brundine reports.
At Ken Sanders' Rare Books, beat poetry nights and parties celebrating Sanders' friend, the late anarchist and novelist Edward Abbey, are regular happenings. But a special book is bringing in a new set of customers. Ken Sanders opens a locked glass case for a better look at a Bible from 1831. It belonged to the founder of what's been described as America's most famous homegrown faith, Mormonism, also known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Collectors knew Joseph Smith Jr.'s family Bible was out there somewhere. Sanders recalls his reaction when the anonymous owner approached him to take it on consignment.
Raised eyebrows. This is interesting. In our business, you know, you always love to see something you've never seen before. And this is like a living historical artifact to the very foundations of the LDS Church.
Tucked in the Bible are Smith family genealogies featuring Joseph and his first wife Emma's handwriting. They include the only correct birth and death dates for a seventh son who was never named. Experts authenticated the Bible and its origins.
And I had to ascertain that it didn't have any taint of Mark Hoffman about it.
Mark Hoffman was one of the 20th century's most notorious forgers of literature and Mormon documents, turning to bombs and murder to cover up his forgeries. He's now serving a life sentence here.
These were inside of the Bible.
The real deal, Smith's Bible, is drawing a steady stream of history buffs into Sanders' shop. Most are Mormon, and they're quiet as they look reverently at the sacred text of the man they consider a prophet.
Yeah, you can't touch it, but to be that close and see the handwriting, and it's very awe-inspiring.
Michael Cox showed up on a lunch break for a rare glimpse at the tattered and water-stained Bible. Paul Savage, who spent at least an hour milling about, says the book represents more than one family's personal belief.
This is of premier importance to everybody. It's an amazingly rare artifact to be put out on the market, and hopefully it goes to a good place.
Bookseller Ken Sanders believes the Bible belongs with the Mormon Church, but says the owner isn't in a position to donate it. Kurt Bench, a dealer specializing in Mormon books, calls the $1.5 million price tag stunning.
It would be an incredible possession for somebody today, and it really will be interesting to see just what someone is willing to pay for that book.
Today's the last day to catch a glimpse of the Bible. It will be locked away for safekeeping tonight. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundine in Salt Lake City.
It now appears that 10 members of the International Assistance Mission, that's a charity group that provides free medical services in Afghanistan, were murdered in the northern province of Badakhshan. Among them, six Americans, including Tom Little, an optometrist with more than 30 years of experience in that country and a fluent Dari speaker. He was profiled by NPR in 2003, and he was asked why, even during the most violent periods, he stuck it out in Afghanistan.
We've come here to identify, in some small sense, with the Afghan people, and for us, at those periods, just to leave, and when they are not able to leave, just because we're afraid, it seemed dishonest and shameful, almost, to say goodbye to our friends and patients here who couldn't leave.
Earlier today, I spoke with Dirk Franz, he's the director of the International Assistance Mission in Kabul, about the fate of his colleagues.
They've been there for about 3 weeks, and every evening they would call to make sure that everything was okay. The last time we heard from them was last Wednesday. Then on Thursday we didn't get a call, and on Friday we heard from the Afghanistan NGO security office that 10 people were found murdered in the area where our team had last been known to be.
So they were on horseback. They were stopping along the way, setting up camp and offering medical services. Is that right?
Yes. Now, the province in which they were working, Nuristan, is rather unsafe, particularly the southern part. So we had actually agreed that the team should go from the north that is from the Badakhshan area. They were driving through Badakhshan and then close to the border, they actually crossed into Nuristan. That's when they left their cars, went on horseback, and the team has then spent about 2.5 weeks doing their camps in villages and valleys in Nuristan, and they were actually on their way back when we lost contact.
If, in fact, these people who have been found are members of your group, of IAM, what then? I mean, what do you do at that point?
Well, one thing that we have to find out is what has actually happened. When the local police actually found the bodies of 10 people, the police chief basically said this was a robbery. The people were completely stripped of all their valuables. There were no passports, no nothing of value left. Now, that could well be the case. That would actually fit the information that we had, that basically there were no insurgents in the area. But, of course, you never know about bandits and robbers. They can be just about anywhere. Once we have the outcome of the criminal investigation, we can take action.
But you won't leave?
I think that is highly unlikely. We have been in Afghanistan since 1966, when the king was here, when the communists were in power, when various Mujahideen groups were in power under the Taliban, and now I think it's rather unlikely that we would leave. We would only leave in one instance, that is if the government says, we don't want you anymore. We're here basically as guests in Afghanistan, and as long as we're wanted, and as long as we can find people who are willing and able to work under these circumstances, I think it's rather unlikely that IAM would stop.
Dirk Franz is the director of the International Assistance Mission in Kabul, Afghanistan. Mr. Franz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.